Recorded live at Podcast One, this is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
And now here's your host, Daniel Beatty, with a special cast and crew Q&A following a screening of the new film The Seagull, taking place at the WGA Theater.
Good evening, everyone. Oh, we can get some response. Good evening, everyone. My name is Daniel Beatty, and it is my pleasure to host a talk back with some members of the team of this beautiful film that you just saw. So I would like to invite you to join me in welcoming some of the wonderful members of this team. And first, we're going to start with our director, Michael Mayer. Next, we'll have our leading lady, the fabulous Annette Bening.
Yes, yeah.
We have our actor who played Dorn, John Tenney. Thank you. And producer Tom Hulse.
Great.
Terrific. So first of all, congratulations on creating this beautiful, beautiful film. Annette, I understand that the movie started in a personal way around a table in your kitchen.
Well, Tom and Michael might be better at telling that story than I would be. But yes, we were friends, Michael. Tom and I had worked together, Michael and I had almost worked together, and they came to my house, and then what happened?
We had Chinese food. It was really good. And there was a lazy Susan, so we all got to serve ourselves very happily.
Mandarette.
Mandarette, for those That's of right. you who don't know good right. Chinese.
And we basically asked Annette if she would be interested in playing Irina Arkadyevna in a film version of The Seagull. That was something we had been dreaming up.
Beautiful.
And she said, "That sounds great. I did that. I worked on that play when I was at ACT in San Francisco." And amazingly, she said that that was of interest to her.
Wonderful. Annette, I did not get a chance to tell you this yet, but I'm actually a graduate of ACT.
I think I knew that.
You knew that? Oh,
yes.
Okay. What's terrific.
When were you there? I'll tell you when I was there.
Then my Hollywood illusion won't last.
All right, never mind. It doesn't matter. It's timeless anyway.
Exactly. So speaking of timeless, this work is timeless, and you all have very full, busy careers. Why this play? Why now? Why did you make the time, each of you, to work on this project?
I think Tom should start with this. Should start
well,
here.
To answer the question, we have to go way, way back.
Okay.
In the mid-80s, I was sitting backstage at the South Coast Repertory Theater in Costa Mesa.
Nice.
Nice.
During the second act of Chekhov's play, The Seagull. And I was playing Constantine, which meant that my job in the second act was to come on stage for maybe 2.5 minutes, do something very intense and very unusual, and then go back off. So the awesome thing about these plays is that they're ensemble pieces, so that everyone has good and interesting and unique material. But the trick was to find a way to stay inside the story for the whole time. So what I began to do was to sit right in the wings off stage every night and listen to the play and try and keep inside. And then that developed into my fantasizing about what all the other characters were doing during the same time period, and I began to be fascinated with the idea that you could tell all of these stories in a way that you could visit anyone at any time, and that's the beginning of the idea of maybe this might be something for film and not for theater. The actress who was playing Nina, who was just amazing, an actress named Mary Beth Fisher, she lives in Chicago, and she had done another production previously with one of those auteur Eastern European theater directors that worked a lot in America in the 80s, and one of the things that she had the opportunity to do in that production was to appear in a seagull outfit. And that didn't seem so interesting. But she did explain that in their production, the play started at the lotto table in the fourth act. And that just piqued my imagination, my curiosity, and stayed with me as a kind of more film idea than theater idea. And then Michael.
And then we were.
You had.
I had. Tom mentioned this to me. We were walking down Broadway from our offices on 54th Street down to rehearsal on 42nd. So between, so that, what is that, 15 blocks, I think, right? Oh, I, is that right? 15?
Something
like that. Anyway, sorry. he mentioned this concept to me, and I remembered thinking about, I had had a fantasy about doing Othello, where you would visit the first act in between the fourth and fifth acts. Anyway, it just resonated with me as a concept, and so we just started talking about it, and by the time we got to 42nd Street, we had decided we were going to do this movie, and we were going to ask Annette to be in it. It happened, you know, pretty quickly.
So in some simple way, Annette saying yes is why this now, if you will.
Yeah. Absolutely. Speaking about this happening quickly, I understand that the process from the first draft to filming was less than a year?
That's right, yeah.
Wow.
We once Annette came on board, we approached the playwright Stephen Karam, who is a wonderful New York playwright. He won the Tony for The Humans and has been twice Pulitzer nominated. And Tom had read somewhere that he was heavily influenced by Chekhov, and he was a pal of mine. So the three of us had dinner, and we pitched him this idea, and Annette, and he's obsessed with Annette Bening, it turns out. You know, there are a lot of people who are, but he's one of them. And he sparked to it and wrote fairly quickly, I think, and
continued to write.
And continued throughout. But we had a reading at the Public Theater in New York, and we had Annette, and we asked Corey Stoll and Saoirse to do that reading, and we had other friends there reading other roles, and that was the first time we heard it. And it was really terrific, but you know, it was the first time, so then we kept working on it up until, I'd say, just several months before we started shooting, and we had a location, and from the point which we had this amazing location that our brilliant production designer, Jane Muskie, found. We can tell more about that also, but once we knew what the location was, then he could start really tailoring the screenplay to that particular location. And he had Annette's voice in his head from the get-go, but then he could you know, hear Corey and Saoirse and John and all the other wonderful actors that we had. So it kept evolving, and even as we were shooting, too, because he was on set the whole time.
Terrific. I want to talk a little bit about the acting. So a lot of people will say that Chekhov really introduced subtext to the theater. And we know that this is a work that was created for the stage, but because of the nature of his writing, it's in many ways perfect to be adapted to the screen. First to the actors, and then Michael, I'd love for you to chime in. Was there any specificity to how you approached the acting in this work, in The Seagull, considering that it was originally crafted for the stage and you're performing on the screen?
Me?
Yes.
And
then you, John.
That's a good question. I think that the internal work that one does as an actor is very similar. At least it is for me. So I shouldn't speak for everyone, but for me, because I think most acting training is based in the theater, because that's where words live. And that's where we learn to, you know, create that inner life and sustain it over a long period of time. So I certainly suggest to any actors like you to train that way, because then, you know, you do have to eventually, if you want to do television and film, learn about the basics of marks and cameras and things like that. But the inner work is very much the same. And the thing about film versus theater in terms of approaching something like this is the luxury of film is private moments. And that's why a lot of us love movies, because the camera can go in and be with a person in a way that is so intimate, that is unique. And it's a wonderful tool as an actor to have the camera. And at first I was very intimidated working on a set. I felt like a stage actress pretending I was a movie actress for a long time, whatever that means. I was used to being in a big room. I was used to filling a big space and all those things that you're taught as a theater actor. And then suddenly you're asked to speak at a normal volume and the camera's right inside of you. So it's either a very scary thing or it's something that you welcome, the opportunity to try to open up with a camera. So the other thing is that, of course, when you're doing a play, you do it over and over. You do the entire story and you do it many, 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 in some cases, many times. Right. So you're finding moments over and over and over, so that requires a different kind of skill, because you have to find new things to stimulate you. When you're doing a film, you're doing a scene for a day, certainly in our case, not more than a day, right. Part of a day, and then you're done. So in a way, it's quite wonderful and quite freeing, and I had worked on it. When you say I worked on it at ACT, I was a student. I did a student production in a classroom. But I did get to work on it. And once you've worked, like I'm sure many of you here, once you've worked on something, actually, once you've seen something, it's sort of yours. Right. Once you've read it, it's yours. It's a classic, but it's yours, because that's why classics exist. We live in them so fully. So I had studied it, and that helped enormously. So in approaching this, I got to read a lot more, and I read a new biography of Chekhov, who I'm madly in love with. But I'm also madly in love with George Bernard Shaw, yeah, and absolutely. Ibsen, and all of those writers of that period. So it's the collaborative experience that creates the moments. It's working together with other people, Michael and Tom and the designers and all the actors, and it's that group thing that you feed off as an actor.
Wonderful. John?
Well, I can't follow that. I can't follow that. I think you said everything. But it was a true ensemble, and we did all live together and spend time in the house that Jane transformed. And I think that was reflected in the on screen as well, that we all spent time, and the hair and makeup was right there on the set, and everyone had their dressing room, so it was a true ensemble. And Michael was very sensitive to those private moments that the camera captured and allowed us those times.
He threw the ball to you perfectly, so you're up.
Yeah. The idea that we could all be in this place, you know, in the play, Chekhov describes a house on a lake, and the lake has islands on it, and he describes certain of the rooms, and Jane found this extraordinary location in Monroe, New York, and it was a house built by Russian emigres. It had Russian pedigree. Jane is from Russian descent, Jewish Russian descent, and when she was a kid, she went to this house. It was like a kind of a camp, kind of, and she'd be like rowing the boat and stuff. It was amazing.
She swam in
that lake.
That's incredible.
And she had meals in that house. And she remembered it and wondered. She thought, I wonder if that place is still there. She found it. And so everything that, you know, when you make a film, you know, you're hoping that when you cut from one room to the next one, that it will look seamless and it will feel like the same place, even though usually it's 18 different locations, right?
Right.
And the lake is 600 miles away or whatever. It was all right there. And I feel like that, the house, the lake, the environment that she transformed with, you know, a nickel and ingenuity, became another character.
Right.
It was the 11th principal character in this brilliant ensemble. And the actual script was based on what this house was. Mm-hmm. Suddenly there was a scene or two scenes in the solarium. I mean, that was never in the play, right? And you could Annette can look out of her bedroom window onto the lake and see Corey and Saoirse rowing the boat. And Constantine, right downstairs in his study, can look out and see the same thing. You walk, you follow Lizzie Moss from the living room through the hallway, looking through into the study where she sees Mare and Glenn having their moment. She goes out through the breakfast room as Saoirse comes in, and she goes out down the path to the actual lake there.
Right.
So it we were all together. It was like an extraordinary thing, which was lucky since we only had 21 days to do.
Yes, 21 days to shoot this entire film. Amazing. Just as you were giving that description, you named so many different pictures, right? And in the theater, you create sets and you use lighting and how you place bodies on the stage to create these pictures. What was the journey for you to communicate those same pictures working with the cinematographer and through the camera's lens?
Well, we were really lucky to get Matt Lloyd. I had worked with him before on a show at Amazon, and I loved his sensibility and how fast he was, honestly. And he's a great crew that they'll just follow him anywhere. And we talked a lot about the play and a lot about the film, and what we felt and what I feel like, honestly. I think like directors direct the audience; they don't really direct the actors. They tell the audience where to look. And when you're doing a play, you've got the fixed, you know, the proscenium, and it's always a master. And you hope that by virtue of your blocking and the lighting and the acting, that you can tell the audience where to look. With, you know, with a camera, the proscenium keeps moving, so you have all these other options, and you can, you know, you're very dictatorial that way, because you don't have they don't have a choice. They're like, that's the shot they're looking at, whether they like it or not, right? But with Matt, we were able to find a very fluid way of shooting, so that in some cases, in large group scenes, I don't think that you guys necessarily always knew where the camera was going to be, so that there's a kind of spontaneity that's available to us. So that was great. And then working with Jane Muskie and Matt, we were able to compose what parts of the house would look best, what the rooms would look. And Jane was like art directing the woods. I mean, you know, she really was. It was like she was all over it.
Terrific, beautiful. I know for me, part of what moves me about this play is how complex the characters are. No heroes, no villains. You see all sides of the different characters. What for you makes this work timeless? What for you? Where do you find your sort of personal entry into this work for each of you? Tom, you want to start?
I think for me, it's just the humanity of it and the fact that each character is shown at their best in moments and their worst in moments, and no one is made out to be the villain or the hero, and that there is something so nourishing about celebrating our humanity in the times in which we are currently finding ourselves in all of its glorious variety.
Yeah, I was really taken with playing Dr. Dorn, which I actually ironically played when I was 20 years old in college, and I never was a 20-year-old Dr. Dorn. So I'm finally the right age to play the role, and there's a dispassionate part of Dr. Dorn because he removes himself a little bit from the action. As Chekhov, who was also a doctor, would have done, but there was this tremendous compassion to Dr. Dorn, which moved me very much. That he's able to come to Constantine's defense, to be protective with Irina, to have compassion. His humanity, his heart was grounded me in this, and was always very moving to me.
Well, it's the the ridiculousness and the tragic living so closely together in his writing. He was such a genius writer, and that's why we're all here, is because of him and the fact that he was able to do what he did and then found Stanislavski at just the right moment, as he was creating modern acting, basically, with this company. Chekhov fell in love with the theater. He fell in love with the leading actress of the Moscow Art Theater. He wrote the parts for her. And there is a way that he looks at the world that I think we all, I guess I can say, sort of long for, which is with compassion, but also, look how silly we are, look how ridiculous we are, but look how majestic we are, and look how deeply we feel. And everyone is in love, and you're generally in love with the wrong person. So that's kind of funny, and it's also kind of tragic. Brian Dennehy, the part that he played, and that he was there meant so much to so many of us. Anne Roth, who did the costumes,
was nominated for
3 Tonys today.
Wow.
She's 84.
Wow.
She's, yes, and she's one of those people, like the great designers are, they're allies. They're the cheerleaders. They're not just there looking at the clothing or Jane looking at the set. They're saying, you know, what ideas do I have about, you know, do you see a little naked child run by? Or, you know, what idea do you have for the character? Anne thinks about character. So it's not only the costumes are beautiful, which they are, but they're specific and they're right for each human being. So this time in the theater that Chekhov was writing was a groundbreaking time. Things were changing. It was the birth of the modern theater. And so this is what we're picking up on in this movie. And all of that, the breadth of that aspiration is what makes you humble when you approach something. And everybody approached it with humility. And, you know, you throw it out there, you do what you can, and then you hope that maybe someday you're in a theater somewhere and somebody's watching it and they enjoy it.
I want to say one thing about a conversation that I witnessed between Michael and Anne before we started shooting. She was showing him a selection of shoes, And she said, now you want to pay particular attention to which pair of shoes he's going to wear, because I'm sure that you'll have him sitting at his desk and the bottom drawer open, and one of his feet will be propped up on that drawer, and right under there you'll see the handle of the gun.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, oh my God. We actually did it. I don't think that shot makes it into the movie, but
the dramaturgical detail of what...
It's one of the... It's the thing I think that I find most personally moving about this play. I love all of his plays, and this one's very dear to me. But I think it's because there was something holistic about all of us, and many of us are theater... Most of us, I would say, who made the film are theater animals as well as being creatures of the cinema. But he's written a play about a community of artists and about art, as well as about love and humanity. And there's something very beautiful to me about watching him write and these characters living out dreams of what it is to make art and how easily you can cheapen your art, how hard it is to fan the flames of true creativity, how what it is to sell out, what it is to maintain a kind of mastery, how celebrity interferes or accelerates either getting better at what you do or getting worse at what you do. And that's very resonant, I think, for anyone who is an artist and trying to make work in this time. So that felt very contemporary to me. And the search for fame, like Nina's obsession with fame at any cost, and not really knowing what it was that she wanted, and finally understanding something at the very end of the day about endurance and actually finding a method and a way of making work, and not just looking for glory and fame like she starts out with.
There was a lot of difficulty as well. I mean, you know, when you look back and we're sitting here talking, like, oh, it was all this artistic, you know, it was hard, of course. Just like when they first did the play, Stanislavski and Chekhov fought all the time, and I think that's also my feeling, is that that's why they were able to make good things, because they disagreed. And Chekhov wanted it to be funny, you know, and he said, no, it's a farce. We should be getting laughs. This is funny that these people are doing what they're doing. And Stanislavski, who was in the play, of course, eventually, he wanted it to be dramatic and serious. And so it's that synergy of these two people, and that often makes, as I'm sure many of you know, that's what makes something good. So, you know, it's not all agreement. You know, it's creative, you know, wrangling. Well, should it be this or should it be that? And where do we spend our time? And where should the camera be? And should we do the shot that Ann Roth suggested about the guy in the foot and the gun? And wait, don't we give away the gun then if we do that? And is that a good idea? And all of that is what's going on. So it's a lot of, you know, it's a lot of...
Turmoil
and chaos too, but happy chaos and creative chaos in a good way.
I love that. And one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about is why we need artists and why we need storytellers in this time in particular. And Annette, I think you just described that beautifully, which is the mastery of communication that storytellers have, and the understanding that we need often different perspectives, conflicting perspectives, in order to make something that's great. So as a final question, as we wrap up, I just want to take it to a personal place of, why are you a storyteller, and why do you feel we need stories now?
Well, I think we need each. What we need is we need each other to inspire each other. So that's why I like you guys telling the story about when you thought about doing this, because everybody in this, many people in this room, I'm sure, you know, it's what ideas do we have and what ideas do we make happen, and that's always our dilemma. And we, most of us live in a state where we're in a state of trying to make things happen a lot of the time. And so we need each other to inspire each other to make the stories that are timeless. Chekhov is a classic writer, and there's something that, for me, if I look at this story, I think, oh, I can look at the present in a more clear way. Or I was reading a short story, and I was telling one of my kids, I don't know why it is, but I'm reading this particular short story that's describing a particular scene in a particular way, and because of that, I feel like I'm able to look at my life in the present moment with more clarity. I don't know that I can tell you exactly why, but I think maybe you know what I mean. So I hope that that makes sense.
It does. It's beautiful sense.
I think that also the stories we tell become the culture that we leave behind. And I think it's, when you look at history, I think it's the culture, it's the stories, it's the plays, it's the films, it's the paintings, it's the sculptures, it's the music, it's the novels, it's the art of creation. I think that is what defines a society and a civilization. And thank God for that, because otherwise, like, then it's politics or it's an administration. It's war. It's disease. It's, you know, there. It's all the vagaries of, you know, of the horrible legacy of, you know, of humanity, rather than the thing that ennobles us. And so that's why I'm especially passionate about what stories I tell. I try to be, anyway, and I try to be responsible to that, thinking, like, you know, someone's going to watch, hopefully someone will watch this movie next week, let alone, you know, but, you know, in years from now, and hopefully we'll be communicating something worthwhile.
Beautiful. Would either of you like to respond?
I think for me, in a very personal way, I grew up in a household where no one really spoke to each other. My parents didn't speak to each other. And so the four of us kids learned somehow that it was dangerous to express ourselves. And so the fact that stories allow us to understand what the world is like for other people, mm-hmm. and a sea of possibility of how to experience that and how to express what you might be feeling. To be honest with you, I worked on The Seagull twice. Once, not so good, but the one here in California 10 years later. And the pure joy in having a scene every night to play between Treplev and his mother, in which the most intimate, loving things got said, and then the most horrifying disillusion of that, to the point where in this particular time we were throwing things at each other, and the possibility that I learned in the way that acting and acting inside the stories was in a way life-saving, but more life-giving, and what an amazing gift that is.
Friend, and you say you grew up in a family where you were encouraged not to speak, and I grew up in a family where I had to fight to get something to say because everyone was talking, and I think, and so I had to find my place. But I also learned that about listening as well, and I think that's really important to tell. You tell a story and you listen to a story as well, and it's that interaction that is really important. I think we have to listen to each other to find those stories we need to tell as well. So listening is just as important as talking.
Well, thank you all for giving us such a beautiful story to listen to. Congratulations on a beautiful film. Much success to you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Be sure to download new episodes every Wednesday on the Podcast One app, at podcastone.com, or on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to rate, review, and share the show on Apple Podcasts.
Hi, this is Gil Cates Jr. from Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, and I wanted to let you know about a new show on Podcast One called Starving for Attention. Step into the walk-in with celebrity chef Richard Blaze podcast, Starving for Attention, every Tuesday on Podcast One. He's serving up great interviews with Curtis Stone, Thug Kitchen, Andrew Zimmern, and more. Download Starving for Attention, which is what I did from 3 to 8, with 8 years old, that is, with Richard Blaze at Podcast One and Apple Podcasts. And also remember to rate and review.